WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. In the morning, President Biden released a campaign video announcing his 2024 reelection plans. In the afternoon, he promoted his administration's accomplishment in a speech before the National Association of Building Trades Union.
Wall Street didn't build America. The middle class built America, and unions built the middle class. They did. That's the God's truth.
The president met by chance of four more years. The White House confirming the ISIS-K terrorist accused of planning the 2021 Kabul airport attack was killed in a Taliban operation. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee signing three gun reform bills into law, including a ban on assault-style weapons.
AR-15s should not be idolized. They should be prohibited, and that's what we're doing today.
Law already being met by court challenges. This is ABC News. Dozens more Americans have left Khartoum, according to a U.S. official, in a U.N.-organized convoy headed to Port Sudan. According to legislation filed today, Florida Republicans are poised to change a state law in order to allow Governor Ron DeSantis to run for president without having to leave office. Not all employers trust their workers.
With the pandemic waning, more Americans are going back into the office. But if telecommuting has done anything, it's stripped away bosses' trust in their employees. Productivity paranoia, as Microsoft calls it, has a rising number of companies investing in software to monitor workers' activity, even in the office. Some managers get text alerts every time an underling searches for the word interview. One survey from a company that makes virtual private networks says 80% of employers use monitoring software to track worker performance and online activity. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
Fear over a slowing economy and possible recession have weighed on American households. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Metnair. Here's what you need to know. Wisconsin's Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson wants a statewide referendum on abortion, telling the Milwaukee Press Club, quote, "I have a hard time believing people would allow abortion past about 12 weeks," unquote. But he did not say how he would vote. Before Roe was overturned, women in Wisconsin could seek abortions up to 20 weeks. However, Wisconsin voters can't change state law by referendum. Instead, a constitutional amendment would have to be created and passed the GOP-controlled legislature two consecutive sessions before voters could even weigh in. With student enrollment down, school districts in Racine, Wausau, Superior, and La Crosse are among those with plans to either close or combine schools. The Wisconsin Policy Forum reporting the 2020-2021 school year was the seventh in a row that public school enrollment was down in Wisconsin. I'm Jeanette Nair. This is Civic Media News.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Miss our conversations on air? Join the discussion on our social media channels. Find Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find social media for specific shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the gravedigger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standard room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come pick it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football fans. Fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. The news all over the social medias today. Ted Cruz. What hast thou done, Ted? There's some tapes. Evidently, one of the Fox producers taping some stuff with one of the hosts and Ted. Doesn't look good. Doesn't look good. I haven't heard all the tapes. I want to hear all the rest of them. But, you know, at this moment, in this at this juncture, maybe Ted should have gone to Cancun then as well. Because it's not looking good for him. Now, I've had a whole bunch of people go, this is the end of Ted. No. Understand, there's no shame in these people. There's no depth to the lows they will sink. So don't get all excited. I'm tired of people getting excited and all worked up. This is finally, we got the smoking. No, there's no smoking gun yet. Could this be? I don't know. We're going to find out. But interesting day for Ted. So we will see. And look, you know, honestly, couldn't happen to a nicer guy. If it is the smoking gun, if it is finally someone held accountable, could not happen to a nicer guy. Well deserving of whatever punishment comes their way. Now, the other big news, President Biden announced he is going to run for re-election. It is the Biden-Harris 2024 campaign. And, you know, put out a little three-minute video kind of, you know, going through the whole deal. The big moment, he gave a speech in front of the building trades folks, the North American Building Trades Union's legislative conference in D.C., where you got all the bricklayers and pipe fitters and all those folks together, the painters, you know, all of them together to talk about, hey, how are we going to rebuild this country and do the things that Biden has put on the table? And look, he said, look, the line. The middle class built America, and unions built the middle class. Sing along with me, because that was pretty much the chorus of this speech, and it's the right place for him to be. Because as I've said numerous times, you know, it's not right. It's not red hat, blue hat. It's hard hat. It's getting people back to work. It's always the economy, stupid. It's always the jobs. It's always rebuilding for the future. It's always investing in tomorrow that gets you reelected and moves you down the road. And this is something, again, I said during the Trump years, had Donald Trump come out on day one and said, we're going to have a big chunky, because he was floating the idea of a $2 trillion infrastructure bill. Didn't actually do it. Opted instead, and this was a, I'm going to guess this was a strategic plan by the Trump administration at the time to not do anything, but talk about it a lot.
and even more. And every week be infrastructure week so that we're highlighting just how bad our infrastructure is while not actually doing anything about it. And if you remember, there was a lot of fun that came out of the infrastructure weeks. I still remember some of the little hard hats that Trump wore, him driving the truck, one of my favorites, him yelling at the kid, mowing the grass. It was an interesting time. But again, we didn't get anything done, did we? They didn't rebuild bridges. They didn't pave the roads. They didn't invest in broadband. None of that stuff. What's happening right now? And the folks in this room that the president was giving his spiel today, they are the ones who are out there doing the work. And the president said, on my watch, infrastructure has become a decade headline. A decade. He said, that's where you all come in. No, really, he said. That's where you all come in. We've already announced over 25,000 infrastructure projects in 4,500 towns across America. And we're just getting started, he said. Not even close. Union workers will build roads, bridges, lay internet cable, install 500,000 electric vehicle chargers throughout America. And union workers are going to transform America. And union workers are going to finish the job. And see, if it were me, if I were writing that speech, I would say, you're going to finish the job on time and under budget. Because that's kind of the mantra there. And, you know, for me, this speech kind of important. Because the reality is, you know, as much as I beat up on Biden for him not being able to get the words out, not having a real, you know, not being the orator of our day, man, he's getting the job done. I mean, we got the money to finally. Now understand, I've been talking about infrastructure for all 18 years of doing this. You know, every time you turn around, you go, we need something done. Bridge collapse, need that built. Where I was at, where our studio was years ago in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the sinkhole capital of the world at that point, you know, buses were being swallowed up, garbage trucks, you know, you name it, the roads were crumbling. And I was saying, you know what would be great? It'd be great if we had an infrastructure plan that, you know, actually did something with the sewage system. You know, because the sewers under the streets are like 120 years old. Maybe, I don't know, dig them up, put some new stuff in. Could create some jobs. Could give some people some ability to support families. Could be good for us. And that's exactly what this administration has done. Now, all we get from the other side, and this again is one of those moments where you go, what exactly is the alternative message? What are the Republicans bringing to the table? They're talking about undoing everything that hasn't been spent. They're talking about, you know, clawing back all the, because we need to make things worse for the economy. And it's crazy. Now, Biden did highlight the fact that we need to make aggressive investments. That means we need to be spending money. We need to be reshoring manufacturing. We need to bring research and development back here. Something that is not political. Not red hat, not blue hat. Simply hard hat. Back to work. It's about the economy. It's jobs, stupid. And the idea of competing with China. Look, it doesn't mean that China's good or bad. And he said this flat out. It means it's about competition. It's about us winning. And I'm grateful that he's saying that. It's about time. Say, look, you know, we've got to reshore manufacturing. We've got to build stuff here. Now, again, we're in this moment. We're in this weird moment because, as I asked, what do the Republicans bring to the table? What's the grand plan? What's the future going to bring us other than more rich people getting tax breaks and deciding whatever they want is good for them? And the heck with us. I look at North Dakota. The Republican Party in North Dakota, they have decided that women have to give birth. This is no matter what, rape, incest, whatever, you will have that child, woman. And yet, almost simultaneously, they voted against providing school lunch programs for hungry kids. So think about this. We're going to force you to have kids because it's a state's responsibility to make sure you have that baby. We're not going to pay for it in any way, but you're going to have it. And then we're not going to feed them because it's not the state's responsibility. I mean, this is a classic which side are you on moment. And for me, I keep coming back to the treatment of the working class in this country for far too long. Everything to me, no matter what they throw at me, no matter what transgender bathroom issue they want to throw out, or what, you know, gay marriage or whatever, no matter what they, what outrage candy they send me, I bring it back to the fact that as a working class, we're all getting screwed over. And these are the divisive things that are meant to pit us against each other. And the sooner we say, you know what? Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. If someone wants to go do what they want to do, God bless them, let them do it. How am I going to feed my children? How am I going to keep a roof over our kids' head? How am I going to save for retirement? Will my job have decent wages, good conditions? See, this used to be the stuff that we talked about. Oh, no, not anymore. Because, look, the outrage machine has done an incredible job of divide and conquer. And I argue this has a lot to do with the fact that we have massive wealth consolidation in this country. The owners, the wealthy, they control just about everything. And, you know, the weird thing is I had someone, you know, just yesterday ask me, you know, well, because I did a spiel on, you know, on how, why we need to be taxing the rich and, you know, we need to be using that money for investments. Oh, I don't know, like bridges and infrastructure. And they said, well, you know, what's wrong with wealth consolidation? What's wrong with having rich people? And I go, well, nothing if you don't want to have any real democracy. If you want to have a dictatorship, it's great to have oligarchs. It's great to have a handful of people who make all the decisions. It's great to do that. But when you have mass inequality that wealth consolidation brings you, what you then have is social and political upheaval. You have instability, which is, hello, I don't know if you've paid attention. I don't know if you've been looking around lately. There's some funny stuff going on. Let's leave it at that. And the reality is it's harder for working people to make ends meet. So what do? They take control of what they can. And that's just human nature. It's, you know, this is what's a matter of Kansas, only it's America. For me, the idea of having such mass consolidation is the fact of the matter is when you have a handful controlling the entire economy, when you have monopolization like we have going on, there's very limited mobility. So if you were born at the bottom, if you were born like I was, where they put the socioeconomic ladder on top of, you don't get out of there. Which is why, again, I'm not in favor of a handful of people controlling all the wealth. And it's also harder when the socioeconomic ladder is on your back to climb it, to get better health care, to get better educational opportunities, to get better housing. There are so many things that wealth inequality causes in this country that because we have this deference to the wealth class, that we then surrender from ourselves. Which is why the Republican Party has, you know, messaging-wise, masterfully, you know, the old party, I'm crazy today, but it was always low taxes, less government, deregulation. And you go, who benefits with lower tax rates? Who benefits with the deregulation? Who benefits in that world? No government. Who benefits? Well, the wealthy and the powerful. The working people then just become the tools. And as I've said a number of times, there's a move in this country to move us back to the good old days of the Lochner era, where if you were hungry enough and desperate enough to work in poverty conditions for desperation wages, well, that was your liberty, your freedom. Don't you love when people talk about freedom and don't actually know what it means? I love when people talk about freedom, and I've come to the reality that anybody who throws out that freedom word means their freedom. They don't give a tinker's damn about yours or anyone else's, especially my religious folk. But we seriously are. We're in a this, which side are you on moment. And Biden running for re-election, I wish he were 20 years younger. But I'll tell you, the policies that he is bringing in the older Biden, the dark Biden, the dark Brandon, I'm happy with. Because it means on the other side of this, we're going to be a much more competitive country, moving in a direction of actually making things, and a much more technologically advanced country.
because we're going to be investing in the future. So I'm interested to see where the right attacks, because the Twitter mafia, the blue check mark folks, they were all in defense of the Fox guy and the Ted Cruz. We will see where it takes us. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I got a lot to get to, a lot to talk about. You miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Always there, always available for, well, I think a couple of years worth up there. So you got a lot of catching up to do if you've missed anything. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey is calling on Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to pack it in, a resignation. Because, look, you know, there's a lot here. There are a lot of allegations of corruption. I mean, when you're the high guy sitting on the highest court in the land and you're claiming, well, I didn't know how to fill out the form. What a form? You mean I had to fill that out? You mean check that box? I wasn't sure what the box meant. It's how we've always done it. You know, all of the excuses that judges would never fall for, he seems to be making. Now, is he going to resign? No, heavens, no. But I give him credit. I give Markey credit for coming out and saying, hey, this is, your reputation's unsalvageable. And I would argue not a great reputation to begin with, but hey, we'll see. You know, John Roberts was asked to come testify. John Roberts said, no, thank you. I don't want to have to talk about this. And this is, again, another one of these moments where if it's you, if it's me, if it's any working person who gets caught up in this, do you think you got the option? Do you think you get to go, no, I think I'd prefer not to? Of course not. They're dragging you in there. And the thing that bothers me is it's not just, and I said this from the beginning, you may remember when this story first broke, I go, every one of them are doing it. Every one of them are bought and paid for by some billionaire, especially the six that are on the right. Every one of them. And we now find out that Neil Gorsuch, couple of days after his confirmation, guess what? The law firm, big law firm, head of this big law firm, bought Gorsuch's property for a whole bunch of money. Some $500,000 that Gorsuch made selling this property to this CEO. And understand, they had extensive business before the higher court. And again, you know, he had Gorsuch who failed to identify the buyer on any financial disclosure. And I know it's those things are just so difficult. They're so difficult to fill out. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you today?
Oh, I'm insane. How are you?
I'm good. I'm still trying to figure out these forms because these forms are so complicated. They're so difficult that, you know, someone sitting on our Supreme Court, just too difficult for them.
Yeah, they're probably related to people in West Virginia. But, you know, the reason why I called was you were talking earlier, and what I wanted to say was, you know, the type of government that the Republicans and their base seem to want is all we have to do is just look a little bit out of Sarah Palin's backyard and into Russia. And that's basically what they want. They want the dictator president in charge and then the oligarchs. I listened to, have been listening for a couple of years to a man who fled Russia last fall. He had lived all over the world, works for an international corporation. And he recently was saying that all the money that was taken in by Putin and his little pals, and they were supposed to be spending on the equipment and so forth. And, you know, it's obvious now with all everything falling apart for them, equipment-wise.
Yeah, so what you're saying is the military is doing such a poor job because they stole all the money that was supposed to go into upkeeping the equipment.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, that's exactly seems to be what they want, is, you know, you have the oligarchs and then everybody else gets the scraps, and you have, of course, you have the national religion, which in this case for Russia is Russian Orthodox. And for y'all listening out there that's going, yeah, they believe in Jesus, it's a Catholic religion, but it's not Roman Catholic. But, you know, it's just obvious to me that the Republican base would be happy with that. But have a good evening,
thanks,
Rick.
Alice, appreciate it. No, and that's not, there's a couple of videos going on TikTok of you know, this guy going around and asking people, would they rather have Biden or Putin? And a bunch of them are saying, we'd rather have Putin because we trust him. And I go, my mind explodes because, you know, I guess, you know, because I grew up during the Soviet era, that I don't trust the Russians. I don't trust the former KGB officer. It's just, I guess it's one of my fatal flaws, perhaps, in right-wing world. But no, the sad reality is we're in this weird spot where, again, we're not holding people accountable. You know, when our Supreme Court justices, when they can get away with this stuff, and look, you know, I want to know who paid off Kavanaugh's debts. I want to know, you know, who's funding Alito. I want to know where Roberts is getting money, because Roberts is the most, you know, the wealthiest guy on the court. There needs to be an investigation, and it needs to happen now. Will we do it? I don't know. Will the Democrats be able to muster? You know, I think they will, but will it go anywhere? No, because we're in our camps. We're siloed off, and we're not able to think about the fact that we've got people sitting on our Supreme Court making decisions about our lives based on who their friends are and who's funding them, who's taking them on vacation. That's angering and frustrating. And it comes back to it's the money, stupid. I saw this story, retired Army General Keith Alexander, who was the head of the National Security Agency under both Obama and W. Bush. It's now been reported that he got something like $2 million in consulting gigs from foreign governments after he left office. $2 million in consulting gigs. 700,000 of that from the Saudis on cybersecurity after Khashoggi was killed. And you go, am I missing something? And the answer is no, I'm not missing anything. It's all about the money. And when these folks have the opportunity to cash in, that flag that they love to wave in our face, that doesn't matter. And this is where my mind goes to, we have to come back together on some level and be able to talk to each other on some level without devolving into whatever the outrage of the day is. Because we are being robbed blind. Every time we turn around, we're getting ripped off. Wages have been stagnant for 40 years and declining. So as we have a billionaire class who's lining their pocket, where'd that money come from? Came from the work that working people did and aren't being compensated for. And we got to start training our thinking to go back to that, what my grandparents' generation understood. and have a tax code that says, you know what, maybe we don't want to have these gazillionaires who can afford to take a Supreme Court justice on a $500,000 vacation at the drop of a hat, or buy a couple of properties for, you know, just in case we want to, you know, maybe, I don't know, influence something down the road. It's kind of angering. It's kind of frustrating. I do want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, pretty good victory out on the West Coast as some delivery drivers have organized at Amazon. We're going to find out about that when we come back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day hundreds of thousands of Detroit area auto workers returned to their jobs after bringing car production to a complete standstill. They walked off the job to protest the union-busting Taft-Hartley bill, then pending in Congress. Chrysler, Ford, Hudson, and Kaiser-Frazier corporations were all shut down. George Romney, head of the Automobile Manufacturers Association, decried the work stoppage as a contract violation, costing the industry millions. The UAW called 350,000 of its members out in protest the day before. As many as a $500,000 area workers walked off the job. Two marches were organized from the east and west sides of the city that brought as many as 275,000 workers, black and white, men and women, AFL and CIO, converging onto Cadillac Square. A reported 65,000 workers from the Ford River Rouge plant alone marched as a contingent to the rally. Planes flew overhead, trailing banners that read, "Oppose anti-labor legislation in Washington, down with Jim Crow legislation, and fight repeal of the Wagner Act." UAW leaders addressed the crowd at the five-hour rally, stating the measures, if passed, would cut the heart of our unions into 1,000 tattered, bloody pieces. They declared the anti-labor bills as nothing more than proposals to punish the innocent and reward the guilty. For the record establishes that responsibility for recent major strikes rests without exception on the shoulder of industry. Briggs Local 212, which spearheaded the protest, marched with banners that demanded an independent labor party, while veteran auto workers carried placards that read, "We veterans didn't fight for union busting." The rally ended with the crowd singing solidarity and joining picket lines at nearby Bell Telephone to support striking phone workers.
Given the rabid right-wingism of most Republican office holders in my state of Texas, you might assume that the climate here is only fit for rattlesnakes, scorpions, and venomous critters of pious political extremism. Yet, the true Texas political character, historically and currently, is vehemently anti-corporate and deeply rooted in the uniting ethic of the common good. For an historic example, look to the state's first constitution. It outlawed banks and required a two-thirds vote of the legislature to form a corporation. And today, grassroots Texans in the rural town of Llano have just demonstrated the power of progressive community values that are common in this supposedly conservative state. The issue was book banning. A batch of political extremists had decided to purge the public library of 17 books. "Porno," they shrieked. Yet none are pornographic. They're simply about ideas and realities that Republican culture war zealots don't like. Namely, books documenting the history of institutional racism in America and the normality of America's LGBTQ community. Common Sense Llano locals rebelled, suing the county government for autocratically trying to control the people's freedom to read and learn. And a federal judge has now ruled that the book banning was flagrantly unconstitutional, ordering the targeted titles back on the shelves. Then, in a collective spasm of knee-jerk ignorance and arrogance, the county's book-banning officials announced that, by gollies, they would just defund and shut down the entire library system. Yeah, that'll teach people to respect authority. Again, though, locals rebelled, turning out in force to protest the officials' political chicanery, forcing them to reverse their closure scheme. This is Jim Hightower saying, as one 10-year-old student in Llano succinctly testified, it's not the county's job to burn the library down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some pretty impressive news coming out of the West Coast. It turns out 84 Amazon delivery drivers have unionized with the Teamsters out on the West Coast. They won a neutrality and voluntary union recognition with this Amazon delivery contractor battle-tested strategies. And I'm going, what? how did they manage that? And that's why I've asked my good friend Randy Corrigan to come talk with us. Randy's the secretary treasurer and principal officer at Teamsters Local 1932, teamsters1932.org, the website, if you want to take a look at their website. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, anytime. It's been a busy few days for us. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Yeah, the news, incredible. But walk me through this. You got a neutrality and voluntary recognition agreement out of these guys. How did you manage that? Out of an Amazon contractor, how did you manage that?
Yeah, you know, there are some employers out there, contractors out there that recognize that they're workforce being union is not necessarily a bad thing. And I think we had that circumstance, the situation here unfold very quickly here over the last week and a half or so. Amazingly, these workers over the last 2 years in this delivery station had been doing concerted activity, had been doing petitions and had been there. And the good thing was is that owner of their delivery station supported them, like they're in Palmdale, California, in the desert. It's really hot in the summer, right? They had extreme heat conditions, allowed these drivers to bring back their packages, not complete their day because it was too hot. And obviously Amazon punished them. And so these workers recognized that they needed some protection under a collective bargaining agreement. And clearly, the owner of the company, of the contracting service, recognized that them being under collective bargaining agreement probably helped him deal with Amazon on top of it, because his caution to Amazon and the things in which that company tried to pass on to Amazon to protect the workforce, their working conditions, and their environment were largely ignored by Amazon. And so it just ended up being a perfect situation. We believe there's a lot more DSPs that are willing to do this across the country, and at the end of the day, the workers themselves can choose to push this in the right direction, and sometimes we're able to gain recognition and get a collective bargaining agreement. That's not my first rodeo in this. It's my first rodeo for it to be an Amazon contractor, but we've been able to find success in this space over the last 25 years repetitively in the transportation industry.
Now, immediately when the news broke, I got emails from people from all over the place going, you know, is this Amazon or is this a contractor? So this is a contractor. This isn't Amazon, because a lot of people are going, you know, Amazon's first unionized and they've agreed to this. This is a contractor, right?
Correct. It's a contractor, but it's also a contractor that ironically, as everybody will see when they get a package delivered at their door from Amazon, it comes in an Amazon van and the driver's wearing an Amazon uniform and everything is Amazon wrapped around it and about it. And at the end of the day, they are a contractor, or are they really Amazon? That poses a great legal question. But most importantly, the pressures in which were put on these workers were put on them by Amazon directly, not necessarily the contractor. And so there's a lot of discussion that will be obviously had in this space in the very near future,
right,
regarding not only the legal argument that we just discussed, but most importantly, where the workers can get a reprieve from the pressures put on them.
Now, the reason I brought that up and I wanted to clarify that is that the number of people have said that they believe that you know, once the contract with this contractor is up, Amazon will shun them away and pursue someone else. Is that a possibility? Is that something you're preparing for?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, you know, we assume that that's what Amazon's going to do. And we think that, you know, Amazon's got a track record of being anti-worker, anti-union, and will obviously move in that direction. And I know we've explained that to the workforce, but the workers have a right to fight for their the work in which they're performing. And even if Amazon decides to cancel the contract or do whatever everybody wants to make assumptions that they're going to do, those workers have a right to fight for that work and obviously encourage other workers to do the same thing that may work for other contractors.
Now, you said something that caught my ear there. They pull up in an Amazon van. They're wearing the Amazon clothes. They're doing the Amazon work. They're delivering when and where and how and all of that. Aren't they actually just Amazon workers? Can't there be an argument made here so that at some point we break down this third-party logistics model? And if you're delivering an Amazon package or even a FedEx package or you know, Bob's, you know, delivery service package, that's who you work for?
There's a very, very, very solid argument on that. Right now, publicly, our position is to protect the workers' right to do what they're doing. And we do have a tentative agreement. I negotiated it. I also put language in the contract that allowed for the contractor to go to Amazon and obviously address issues. And if Amazon was unwilling to adjust their business model and stop the clamping down on it, that they could come back to the union and then we would engage the next step of the process to deal with it. Obviously, the legal path will take its course, but I think everybody knows the answer to the question you just asked. Clearly, if they're in Amazon uniforms, they're driving an Amazon van, Amazon exerts extreme control over the operation. We all know what the law says on that subject, but that's another subject for another day.
Right.
What's up front is what these workers have the right to do and what they have the right to do.
No, and this is incredible stuff. This is great. This is a model to move forward with, especially as the International Brotherhood of Teamsters is negotiating with UPS on their contract to make, you know, those conditions better. This seems to me to be an opportunity to make the entire industry better, no matter if you're driving a brown package car or an Amazon car or whatever. You're making decent wages, hours, conditions, and working in safe working conditions as well.
I think you just hit the nail on the head. You're right. Companies like Amazon have created downward pressure on the working conditions. If you were to know all the details in which these workers' conditions are working under, it's pretty crazy. You know, pictures I personally saw of roads that they had to go down, that they felt they had to do, and they couldn't, you know, just reject the package and say undeliverable. Just the amount of pressure that these Amazon drivers feel is obviously in stark contrast to what a UPS driver feels when they say undeliverable. I'm not going down that road, or I'm not walking into that fence where the poor pit bulls are going to bite me. And so, you know, protections of which are won under the UPS contract clearly are goals in which these workers in Amazon are looking towards. But also you have a challenge in the industry as a whole. Clearly, our members mobilizing towards what they're mobilizing for in holding UPS accountable, but also workers mobilizing at Amazon. And we all know that there are workers that are very unhappy at Amazon across the entire country. And now you can occupy that space collectively and ask workers as a whole to really bring some parity in the industry. These are the opportunities that present themselves, and whether or not these workers are willing to do that, they've taken the first few steps. There are more steps to take.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Randy Corgan, Secretary, Treasurer, and Principal Officer of Teamsters Local 1932. You want to check out their website, teamsters1932.org, talking about the big victory out on the West Coast at the Amazon contractor. You said something a moment ago that caught my attention, and it's one of these things that in talking with employers, I've brought up a number of times. You know, we're trained to believe that there has to be an adversarial relationship between unions, workers, and employers. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, the workers' compensation law still looks at the employer-employee relationship as master and servant. There's a lot of us who still are in that frame, but the reality is anybody who's been in a union long enough knows it's a partnership, and the employees and the union want the company to do as well as the company wants to do well. And it doesn't have to be this butting heads that you could make Amazon a very profitable company and still a very good place to work.
You know as well as I do that 95%, if not 99% of the engagement between workers and the union and the employer in which these workers work for, the members work for, are all, you know, sort of mutual interest engagements. they're not necessarily all knockdown, drag out, punch outs, right? That those are the very rare incidents where most of the time you're collectively solving problems either in the industry or at your employer or, you know, for the customer or whatever it may be. And this misnomer that it's all adversarial all the time is just not true. And the reality is there are spaces in which the employer and the union and the workers can all collectively fight to make sure that there's balance in the industry. Amazon is a perfect example of that being a problem.
No, and I want to make sure that that happens, because a couple of years ago I had convinced an employer that they should go and organize with a specific union and allow them to organize their workers because they needed an HR department and they didn't have the money to be able to do it. And I said, look, this union will help bring you the people that you need to do a better job. And, you know, a couple of years later he came back, he said, it was the best move I ever made.
Yeah, it allows the employer to make sure that there's checks and balances in the system to keep the operation honest, the operators, you know, and the managerial team honest, not just honest, but, you know, on track for what they're supposed to do legally. And sometimes it's ignorance on behalf of management or in middle management or supervision. And obviously having a union ensures that space is always going to be occupied in the right way.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the UPS negotiations. Obviously, that's the hot button issue right now with your union. Anything going on that we should know about? I know I've gotten a lot of communications from my friends in Chicago and Minneapolis saying, you know, we're going to strike, and I'm not so sure, but I'm curious if you've got any insight that you can share. I know not anything that's going on at the bargaining table, but are we positive? Are we feeling, you know, in a positive direction at this moment?
I think so. I mean, I really do. You see this mass mobilization of the membership. You see an education program rolling out to where members understand that if you weren't happy with the previous contract, you have a right to express that opinion. And now you're back in bargaining now, and you're going to vote to go one way or another. Ultimately, the members decide whether they're going to go on strike. And, you know, to say we're going to go on strike or not go on strike is all premature. Simply because I've been doing this job long enough to know that you don't know that until you get to the very end. Once everybody's got to decide at that moment, this is crisis. Is this worth going to the street or not? First, employer with the demands. Second, workers, members, based on ratification or acceptance. And I think that it's called preparing for the worst and hoping for the best.
Yep.
Preparing everybody and making sure they understand what their rights are and what they're willing to do and what, you know, if they're willing to do it. And then you get to the, you know, to the point where an offer is served up, then they decide at that point whether it's acceptable.
Yeah, no, as someone who's walked across that threshold in my life, it's not an easy thing to do, but sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Strikes are always the last arrow in the quiver and no one wants to do it, but sometimes you're backed into a corner and it's the only way to jumpstart things. My mind keeps coming back to UPS has the resources to make the contract much better. And I keep coming back to the stock buybacks because nothing upsets me more than one of these companies who we've given so much to in tax breaks and so much to see them then take the money that they claim they were going to put back into new vehicles and new equipment and raises for workers only to have them shove it in their own pocket. So nothing makes me crazier than that. And UPS had a pretty big stock buyback program.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, that's obviously where the consternation comes from and some of the struggle where, you know, the membership is like, hey, wait a minute. And, you know, that's the bargaining process. That's the beautiful part of the bargaining process right now.
It is
we have the right to work our way through it. And it'll all come to a head, you know, sometime in late July, mid to late July. And we'll either be walking off the job August 1st or, you know, everybody moving on and ratifying. But I want to tie it into this moment with Amazon. The reason why it's important to talk about Amazon in this same space is the mobilization of the members at UPS in the industry is absolutely tied to what's going on with the workers in Amazon, because they both impact one another in the industry. Our members impact the workers at Amazon, and the workers at Amazon obviously impact the members at UPS or DHL or Freight or any of the other transportation companies. And this is a moment in time in which we have to capture where workers recognize their power in the industry and they're able to exercise it in the right way. When you see a low-end employer like Amazon, the working conditions, these people we just organized don't even get paid holidays. They don't even get paid holidays. Like, you get holidays. There's four holidays that they were getting, but none of them are paid. And that's coming from Amazon. Amazon pats himself on the back as a great employer that they provide all this great service. Like, wait till you hear some of the things we roll out. We're going to wait on the details of the agreement until it's ratified by the group itself. That's the fair thing to do. Don't allow everybody else to offer their opinion on something before the group itself has the right to make their decision. Within the next couple of days, the contract will be ratified. We know that it will. We're confident that it will. And then we'll talk about some of those pretty crazy conditions that they were working under, and then what that contractor was willing to agree to, and then clearly what Amazon's going to have to step up to the plate and deliver on themselves, because they're on the hook too here. Yeah. And it is an industry-wide approach. This stuff at UPS and Amazon happening at the same time, the reason I'm double down on this message right now is that once we get past August 1st and the contract is either accepted at UPS or we're on strike, at some point that contract will come, negotiations will come to a conclusion, whether it's August 1st or July 31st or sometime late August, September, or however long the labor dispute may be. What we can't do is, whether we work in freight or UPS or anywhere else in the transportation industry, is then look past what the workers at Amazon are doing, because that fight is the fight for the future of this industry when it comes to transportation.
I'm right there with you. Randy, I appreciate the time. When you do roll this out, I hope you'll come back and share it with us so that we can see what advancements were made and maybe how we spread this to other people who want to do the same. But Randy Corrigan, appreciate the time.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Randy, our good friend at Teamsters Local 1932. Check out their website, Teamsters1932.org. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Got the talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day of an important victory for any woman in the United States with a pension. The Supreme Court handed down its decision in a case known as Los Angeles Water Department versus Manhart. Manhart and a group of current and past female employees at the department had sued. The women were required to pay more into their pension than were the men. The reason for this policy was that women lived longer on average. That meant that the 2,000 women employed at the water department had to contribute nearly 15% more than their 10,000 male co-workers. The women argued that this violated Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibited discrimination based on gender. The case wound its way through the court system. The ACLU filed a brief in support of the women's cause at the U.S. Supreme Court. The women won their case in a 6-2 decision. The majority of justices decided that even if women lived longer than men as a group, it would be impossible to know how long each individual woman might live. Therefore, individual women could not be held to a different standard for their pensions. The case was an important affirmation of the protections of the Civil Rights Act. Yet despite this victory, the women were not returned any of the extra money they had been required to pay into their pensions. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, writing for the majority, found that such retroactive payments could be, quote, devastating for a pension fund. He wrote that, quote, administrators of retirement plans must be given time to adjust gradually to Title VII's demands. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I tell you, talking to Randy, that's a pretty big deal, organizing those contractors. And and being able to press for better opportunities. And look, we've talked to some of these drivers, and the conditions that they work under are really, really horrible. Just bad. And the wages aren't great. The conditions aren't great. The benefits aren't great. And it's because Amazon really does squeeze these contractors. So this could be a moment. This could be an interesting moment where these contractors, because you know, the part that catches my mind is, you know, they allowed a voluntary recognition of the union by going, okay, fine, organize them. This could be a moment where these contractors go, yeah, by all means, organize our workers and help us fight Amazon to get us more money to pay them better. That could be part of this as well. And it'll be interesting to see where this plays out. But this is a big deal. And what Amazon does next will be a big deal as well, because immediately, I asked Randy, you know, what are you expecting? I had a bunch of people go, you know, how much you want to bet that they don't make it past this contract? And that's been the MO of a lot of companies, which is the reason they set up these contractors. They set up these third-party logistics companies so that if they do have the audacity to organize and demand more, you just cut them off and bring in another one. This is why we need major comprehensive labor law reform in this country. And again, the organizing they're doing is really, really incredible, which is why the email I got today, I want to get into. Janice, listening on KTRC in Santa Fe, sent me this email, said, Rick, love the show. I feel I've known you for years, and you are that coworker I look forward to hearing from every day. Well, thank you, Janice. That's very nice. She says, I want to talk to my friends about worker organizing and coming together. What's the best message? And this is one of those things you go, well, the best message is organizing is about building worker power. It's about building solidarity between you and me and other coworkers saying, you know what, we have a mutual interest. We want to do better. We want our kids to be able to have better health care and better educational opportunities. We want to do better. We want to have better wages so we don't have to, you know, work as much overtime. It's the importance of collective action and solidarity is, you know, I can't emphasize that enough, that interconnectedness of us being, you know, one entity fighting for the same thing. Because look, the reality is capitalism has done an amazing job, has a long history of exploiting workers, of you and me, ultimately to benefit who? Certainly not you or me, to benefit the handful at the very top, the folks who, well, own everything. And by organizing, you have the ability to fight back, to maybe counteract a little bit of it. You're never going to be equal, but the idea that you're fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, that means a lot. It's incredibly important. Now you go, but that's just in the workplace. And what I say, the reason that the right is opposed to unions and organizing is because it empowers people. When you can say no at work, I'm not going to drive down that alley. I'm not going to go into that place where those four pit bulls are. I'm not going to take a truck down the road with bad brakes. It empowers people in the workplace. And that, in turn, empowers people politically. And what our wealth class certainly does not want are empowered people. You know, George Carlin has that bit, you know, about where he goes, you know, they want people just smart enough to, you know, run the machines and do the paperwork, but not smart enough that we're getting screwed over. And we are getting screwed over. So for me, while fighting for better wages, hours and conditions in the workplace is great, we should be fighting for structural changes, lasting changes to benefit workers, you know, across the board. This third-party logistics stuff, the use of misclassifying workers as independent contractors. We should be fighting this stuff. Instead, they're going, no, this is your only way forward. This is the only way you're going to be able to make a living because, you know, they're going to take this from you. No, we should be fighting for us together. You know, I've had people go, why do you care about the LGBTQ issue? Why do you care about the trans issue? And honestly, it's not my issue. None of it's my issue, but what I understand is if you can divide us on those issues, if you can tear us apart there, you can easily divide us in the workplace. So this idea of being inclusive and having some measure of inter interconnectedness. What's the buzzword they use? Intersectionality or intersectional, you know, behavior. If we can do that, if we can bring people from all different diverse backgrounds, different ideas and ideologies, all them together and say, you know what? We want better wages, hours, conditions. We want better opportunities for working people, and we're not going to be divided by the simplistic nonsense you keep shoveling at us. They know we win.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic ABC Media app. News.